You're about to listen to an episode of Shed with Eric Adams. This is from Season 2 from the year 2023, presented to you by MVY Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Shed. Today on the podcast, we are joined by Kevin Hooks. Kevin has had a successful career in Hollywood as a director, producer, and actor. He got his start playing the lead in the movie Sounder, and in his recent attempt at retirement, he's been living on the vineyard. In this episode, Kevin talks about a career shaped by stories about race. Welcome to Shed, Kevin.
Hey, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you, man.
Yeah,
really great to have you.
I'm looking forward to it.
Where to begin with you? Your career covers so much. I'm so tempted to just dive into Sounder because for anybody my age and older, particularly African Americans, Sounder was such an important film. I don't know. Do you realize how important it is or how important it was when you were making it?
Yeah, I had an inclination that it was an important film when we were making it. And I remember one day I said to Martin Ritt, the director, I said, this movie could get nominated for an Oscar, couldn't it?
Hmm.
And he immediately shut that down. And he said, no. It's much too small a film. And I think he was doing that, A, because he believed it. Mm-hmm. It was a small film. And then B, of course, as a director, he didn't want his 12-year-old, actor to sort of get lost in the whole glamour of filmmaking and being in movies and that whole thing.
Did you get lost in the glamour of making that movie?
No, I did not. Kind of hard to get lost in the glamour when you are running through, cow dunk in southern Louisiana, in 95-degree weather with, 50% humidity. So, no, I didn't get caught up in that at all. But also, I didn't get caught up because I had actors, namely two stellar, brilliant Academy Award nominated actors in Paul Winfield and Cicely Tyson.
Giants.
Who were there holding down the fort, and they kept me focused. They really, really sort of set an example of a work ethic that that I wasn't even aware of going into it. But once I was in it, I knew I was... I had to bring my A game, whatever that was.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I didn't get caught up in it. It was just about the work. But I knew the work was important. I knew the story was important.
How old were you at the time?
I had my 13th birthday on the set.
Wow.
So I started it, I was 12. Mm-hmm. And I ended it feeling much older than that, frankly. A lot of revelation in that experience.
Was that your first acting job?
No, it wasn't actually. It was my first major film.
Mm-hmm.
But I had started out a few years earlier at the age of 10, 9 or 10. I did an episode of my father's series. My father's Robert Hooks, and he is retired now, but mm-hmm. was a actor, director, producer. In his own right, theater founder, founded the Nigger Ensemble Company in New York in the 60s and the whole thing. And at any rate, so that was, he was doing a series called NYPD.
Mm-hmm.
And I did an episode of that, one scene with a guy by the name of Al Pacino. And
I heard of him.
Yeah, he did okay for himself.
He did all right.
Yeah, he did all right. That was my first gig, and then I started going to interviews. And Sounder came about because Lonnie Elder III, who was sort of my play uncle and a dear, dear friend of my father's, wrote the adaptation from the book. And
it was a child's book from
yeah,
what
it was a children's book. Exactly.
Basically,
right.
It was through the eyes of the dog. And
it was the boy and the dog. Yeah, exactly. And in fact, that's that my uncle was responsible for giving the family names because the book was all the boy, the mother, the father. It was very, very, very simplistic in that way, or universal, if you will. So Sounder was sort of my first big film, but I had done JT, was the first thing. After I did NYPD, I starred in a CBS children's special called JT, about a boy in Harlem with a cat. Jane Wagner wrote the book and the screenplay. So that was my first sort of, you know, coming out party. And then I got Sounder and, you know, that kind of got me going.
Mm-hmm. The thing I remember most about Sounder is it was the first time I felt emotional after watching a film. It was also the first film I remember watching that really focused on the life, the strength, the love that existed in Black families. You know, watching it again the other night, I realized that there were themes of systemic racism throughout the movie. You know, the idea of sharecropping and what that life was like. You were entering the
criminal justice system.
How prisoners were made to work for the benefit of a company. I think it was a mining company in the film.
Right.
And when they were no longer of use to the company, they were released early.
Yeah.
Also, the first school that you went to in the film was a segregated school.
Mm-hmm.
And you were one of a couple of students sitting in the back. And the teacher, I remember, was reading from Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah.
And you could see your disengagement with the education process.
Yeah.
But when you stumbled into an all-Black school with an all-Black teacher who read to you about W.E.B. Du Bois,
right,
it changed things for you.
Yeah. There were, you know, it's very interesting you mentioned that you saw it recently, because I did as well. Less than a month ago. I was in Los Angeles, and the Academy Museum, Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, now has a museum that's only been open a few months, but they've got a state-of-the-art theater, and they are doing a series called Sunday Cinema or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And a few weeks ago, they screened Sounder, and they asked if I would attend and do a little Q&A before the screening.
Wow.
Which I did. I was reluctant, to be absolutely honest.
Why?
With you. Well, because Sounder is such a deeply personal experience for me and has been. It's difficult for me to look backwards at it. So many of those great people who were involved in it are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so my first instinct was that I didn't want to go there. And in fact, I hadn't seen the movie for about 25 years before the other night. So as irony would have it, when I got the email about attending, I was just about finished with Cicely Tyson's autobiography, which my mother gave me for Christmas, and I was reading it. And I think, you know, listen, you said it was an emotional experience for you just watching the film. Imagine what it's like, you know, to have experienced it. And there was something about that irony of reading her book and then having this email show up that when I slept on it, I realized that was Cicely telling me, that was her handing the baton to me.
Wow.
And saying, this is now your legacy to hold up for all of us. So, yeah, I'll get a little choked up. But, you know, it brings back incredible memories. But I watched it that night and with my family. And every time I have seen that film throughout my life, I've had a different reaction to it.
What was your most recent reaction?
Oh, those themes that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's hard to separate sometimes the experience of making a film, especially one as seminal as that, where you're so young when you go into it. It's like going on a grand vacation, you know, with your family when you're a kid. And of course, you remember it a certain way, in spite of the fact that it may have been something else.
Mm-hmm.
And in this situation, I think that, you know, as you get older and you become more aware of, you know, what race really represents and how it is perceived in this country, you know, and particularly post George Floyd, mm-hmm. 2020, mm-hmm. All of the issues that we are dealing with critical race theory in schools, or not, that stuff you can't help but carry into the viewing of that film. And so it's had a different impact on me. I was really happy that I saw it. I really was. Mm-hmm. It was time for me to revisit it.
What's your family think of it?
It's interesting. I talked to my daughters, you know, I was curious about that right away. Mm-hmm. Right. And, to each one of them, I have three kids and they all kind of said, it was like watching a family movie, like a home movie, because not only am I in it at age 12, my brother, their uncle, is in it at age 8.
Right.
So they were like, it's just the two of you guys fooling around like, you know, you do now. So you're just younger. But no, they obviously get the importance mm-hmm. of the film. I think it's, and I thought this was a unique opportunity to watch it with them, mm-hmm. which is another reason why I decided to do it. You know, it was sort of a once in a lifetime opportunity.
Yeah.
And, so yeah, it's had a tremendous impact. I'm really thankful to have been a part of it, and to be able to carry that legacy, you know, forward.
Mm-hmm. It was in the realm of Roots for many of us. You know, it predates Roots, but it had the same kind of effect of feeling a sense of pride, being in touch with how much we've overcome and how much
right.
resilience we have as a people
right.
that we've gotten through. And also the bond with your father, I
yeah.
thought was particularly
yeah.
touching. And I looked at it differently now that I'm a father, seeing the connection that you had with him and
yeah.
and your journey to really reclaim him was really emotional.
You know, it's funny you mention that because, you know, that bond, you know, there's a scene in that film when, not to give it away, but I'm hopefully everybody's seen it
by
now.
If you haven't, you need to.
But there's a scene in there where I get a letter that I've been accepted to this school, this all-black school that you were talking about. And at that point, my father's returned home from prison injured. And I really just want to stay home with him. Mm-hmm. And he's adamant that I should go to the school. And I go running off to this creek and, you know, he follows me and we have this chat. And that scene, I remember that day like it was yesterday. Every time we did that scene, I cried.
Wow.
I couldn't help it. Because the theme of family, he has a line in that and he says, we're going to love you no matter where you are.
I remember.
And I just, that blew my mind. I never quite thought about love, family support in that way. Like, we're going to love you no matter where you are in this world or beyond, mm-hmm. right? So we did that scene. But there's a one key thing in that I think, I don't know who came up with it, but it was something that when I directed the sort of second version of that for ABC some mm-hmm. years later, I put back into the script, and it was the handshake.
Which handshake?
There were handshakes between he and I, the father and the son, throughout the film. And it starts at the very beginning, the night that they go hunting, and they come back and he says good night and they have a handshake. And then, and it goes on, and they have another handshake when he goes to visit him in the jail through the bars. And then the last one that I recall is there in that scene on the creek, and there's another handshake. And, you know, it's like one of those things, you don't see families do that. And it meant so much that, you know, I put it back in the other script and I said, no, we're doing the handshake because it's such a visual bond and it's such a sign of respect. He also said something to me in that scene that I just recently heard. And that's the other thing, is I hear different things when I watch it. And he said something like, I think his last line to me in that scene is, do you think we can get to be friends?
Yes.
And I just, It just blew my mind. Do you think, I mean, imagine a father saying to his son, do you think we can get to be friends? And that tells you so much about the humanity of that relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think that's stunned a lot of people, particularly non-blacks. Mm-hmm. In fact, Cicely talks about in her book, when she was on the press tour, that there was a reporter that asked her a question about it, but he framed his question by saying that he had no idea that black families behaved or treated one another in the same way that he treated his children.
Wow, what a statement.
Yeah, and she said she had to do everything she could to hold back from really saying what she wanted to say. But, you know, I mean, that spoke volumes. And I think that film, so much of what was wonderful about that film was not the spoken words, although they were brilliant. Lonnie Elder was nominated for an Oscar, as well he should have been. But it was the work that was done between the lines, the gestures, the looks, the behavior, the body language, you know, those things really were masterful from Cicely and Paul. And they taught me so much.
Interestingly, I think the picture was nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah.
Cicely received a nomination for Best Actress. Paul Winfield received a Best Actor nomination.
Right.
But you were really the one that carried that film, Kevin.
Yeah, I don't want to go there.
Why not?
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. No, it's you know, it's a very interesting thing because in a lot of ways, you're right. My work, you know, I'm very proud of for sure. But when I look at it, you know, they were very, very deserving. You know, the work that they did, I thought was just phenomenal. And you know, what makes it even more remarkable is that they weren't on screen as long as I was. But also too, you know, it's funny cause I think about that a lot, you know, that was the year that The Godfather was nominated.
Is that right?
Yeah, so the Best Supporting Actor category was, you know, populated by at least three actors from that. Jimmy Caan, Robert Duvall, I think Pacino was in there too. So I didn't have a chance,
you
man.
Shot.
You know, I should have been in The Godfather. I would have had a chance.
Not sure what part you would have played.
I don't think I would have liked it as much. That's for sure.
Wow, I hate to leave Sounder, but... I want to move on to some of your other work. And, you know, one of the things you did that was equally as important, well, maybe not equally, but very important to me as a young man was The White Shadow. All my friends and I watched it. You know, it was one of our favorite things to watch.
Yeah.
You know, and my black friends, my white friends, the adults could watch it. It really had a mass appeal.
Yeah.
It was lighthearted, you know, and funny, but also, it tackled some really serious subjects.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Gun violence, teen pregnancy,
yep.
Sexually transmitted diseases.
Sexual identity.
Sexual identity. I mean,
yeah.
It was really ahead of its time in that way.
Yeah, yeah. No, it really was. I think, you know, Bruce Paltrow, who was the executive producer, creator of that, along with Ken Howard, it was based upon Ken Howard's... I believe high school experience where he was, I think he was the only white guy on the basketball team. So they kind of flipped the script on that.
Interesting.
A little bit. But I think it was really important to them to address those kind of issues. And you're right. It was a perfect balance of sort of, you know, important issue oriented themes, but dealt with, you know, in an environment where, you know, it was a lot of camaraderie, a lot of fun, you know, and a lot of light humored kind of approach. So, yeah, The White Shadow was obviously very important to me. You know, it's it was sort of like adult college in a way. I was 19 or 20 when I was doing it. I think when we finished, I was 21. So, mm-hmm. yeah. So, you know, those were those formative years that, you know, if I wasn't doing that, I would have been in college mm-hmm. somewhere. So that was sort of my college experience, mm-hmm. right? I just got paid as opposed to paying them, which was really nice. If you can call what they were giving me like pay, but at any rate, more like a stipend at that point. Mm. But you know, it changed my life. Again, it was something that we were very proud of in terms of how it dealt with current events and issues. But then from a personal standpoint, it was also the place where a decision was made. I was approached by Bruce Paltrow during the fifth episode of the first season. So we had just gotten started.
Mm-hmm. He went on to do a lot of directing, some very important films, didn't he?
He did. No, Bruce mainly did. He stayed on the producing side,
oh, he
but
did.
He went on to do Saint Elsewhere,
okay,
which is where I started directing,
mm-hmm.
and of course, you know, he's the father of Gwyneth,
mm-hmm.
and you know, so at any rate, he came up to me during, I'll never forget, he came up to me during the fifth episode, and he said, what are you going to do after the show is over? And I thought he was basically telling me that the show was being canceled, and mm-hmm. I was shocking because we were just getting started. And I asked him that, and he said, no, I just wondered because it's very difficult for black actors, and I know a lot of black actors who have had a hard time kind of maintaining their careers.
Wow.
It's not enough roles. So first of all, I thought, wow, that's incredible that he's aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
But where's this going? And he said, well, listen, if you have any aspirations at all to do anything other than act, i.e. writing or directing, feel free to take advantage of our resources. You want to go to the editing room to see how it all gets put together. You want to come to casting sessions, you know, production
what a kind
meetings
thing for him to do.
Right. And, you know, at first, again, I was skeptical because mm-hmm. I thought, that sounds too good to be true. And then, you know, again, I slept on it. I woke up and I said, you'll never know if it's legit if you don't take advantage of it. You have to call them on that. And so for the next year, I was on the set every day, whether I was working or not. And I was there first thing in the morning at call. Mm-hmm. And I was there last thing at night at wrap every day.
Mm.
And eventually they gave me an opportunity, plugged me into an episode to direct. And then we got canceled.
What'd you do wrong?
So, yeah, it's like, it's my fault. So I did not get a chance to direct an episode of White Shadow, but they promised me the next show
mm-hmm.
that they would let me direct. And that was Saint Elsewhere. So that's where I started directing.
Wow. And yeah. A number of guys from the cast went on to have
yeah.
careers in directing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thomas Carter went out before me, and he was a mentor for me. Timmy Van Patten went on to do all kinds of stuff, Boardwalk Empire, The Sopranos, mm-hmm. Sex in the City.
Mm-hmm.
He has really carved out a great career for himself. And there are others, too, mm-hmm. that came from that camp. So it was a life-changing, you know, experience for a number of reasons.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder, you know, growing up, when you first became of race and the implications of race.
You know, there are different levels of awareness, right? And so, you know, there's the sort of like unconscious awareness of something, meaning, you know, you find yourself in an area that outside of the one that you live in.
Mm-hmm.
Which is all black. And then you find yourself at the 9th Street Market,
mm-hmm.
which back then was called the Italian Market.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like nobody looks like you, right? Or you find yourself passing through Manayunk
mm-hmm.
with the basketball team on a bus and nobody looks like you. And you're like, oh, wow, okay, this is different.
And I'm still in the same city. I'm literally
right.
only, you know, a handful of blocks from where I live.
Right. And you feel a difference, right? And so I think that was sort of the first thing that feelings that I got about race
mm-hmm.
As a young kid growing up.
Because what were those feelings, Kevin?
they were feelings of discomfort, frankly, and confusion, because, you know, I came from a family with my father, of course, being in the industry. I came from a family that was very inclusive. You know, we were in the arts. And so, you know, we were around a lot of different people from different cultures, from different walks of life. And so I sort of carried that with me, those expectations with me wherever I went. And when I learned that that wasn't the case, particularly when I went to private school, when I, right after Sounder, I went to a private school in Philly, Friend Central School, which was wonderful, by the way. It was great. And I still have contacts there, Quaker School. And, but, you know, that world was different also. So, you know, these were things, this is where I started to put it together. But I have to say that where it really hit home for me was in Southern Louisiana as a young teenager at that point, living in Louisiana for those 2.5-3 months that we were there doing Sounder. And there were a couple things that, that really were, you know, I laugh about it now, but I remember it really kind of enlightened me as to where I was. And that was the first day that we got to Louisiana. We got off the plane and we were hit by that humidity and the heat. And it was just, and you have to keep in mind, I was 12, my brother was 8. So, you know, the first thing we thought when we got to the hotel room is we saw a pool. And that was something that we didn't have an opportunity to do. You know, we had to go to the Y to go to the pool in our neighborhood.
Why?
Right? To the Y, the YMCA.
But why?
Well, because we didn't have a pool. I mean, we didn't, you know, I mean, there were outdoor pools, but we preferred to go to the Y. But that was preference. But we got down there and we were like, Dad, we want to go swimming. So we get to the hotel. And the first thing we do before we unpack anything is we dig through, we find our trunks, we put them on. And he's like, okay, we're going to go downstairs. And I remember we used to do a race. So we jump in the deep end of the pool, and then you have to stay underwater and you have to sort of swim to the other end. And that was my brother and I did this thing.
Right? So did my brother and I.
Yeah. So we did that. Now, you have to remember that when we get to the pool, there's nobody that looks like us. It's it's all, you know, white folks that are around the lounge chairs and whatnot. And the pool is full of white kids. And so we didn't dawn on us that this was a segregated pool. And we jumped in, and I can only liken it to the opening scene of Jaws, where from the shark's point of view, you see all of the kids scrambling out of the pool and hands coming in and reaching kids and pulling them out. And by the time we got from one end to the other end of the pool and came up, the pool was empty.
Wow.
And I remember looking around and I looked at my father, and we kind of shared a look. And then we looked to my 8-year-old brother. And we're like, okay, we're down here in the deep South. This is the reality of it. I knew what it meant, but it was what, how was he going to deal with it? And he just kind of took a few beats and he looked around and he said, this is great. We got the whole pool to ourselves. And so everything was cool.
What was the look between your father? What was unsaid there?
This is the South. You know, this is the culture of the South. You are not welcome here. And it was a conversation and a dialogue in one look, because the thoughts that were going through my head, and I'm sure the thoughts that were going through his head, were being communicated without words. And, you know, because this was 1970. So, you know, I grew up, you know, during the civil rights movement and watching, you know, the March on Washington and, you know, the whole Selma thing. And, you know, all of that stuff was either on television or in jet or ebony, one or the other. So I saw a lot of those images, you know, and I knew that there was hostility towards people who look like me, you know, but it's one of those things that children have a tendency to sort of put things away until they need them. And what became, you know, painfully apparent in that moment was you got to protect yourself. You have to really be aware, much more aware than you've ever been, because you are kind of in enemy territory. And that's, it's unfortunate.
Do you think that that's still true in some ways today?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, listen, it's all fear-based, right? You know, the bottom line is that, you know, our unfortunately, you know, the culture in this country in large part has been about debunking the truths of this so-called democracy and the foundation of this so-called democracy. Yes, it's an experiment, but to a lot of people, it's not. And that's dangerous. So yeah, I think that, I still feel that way for sure. And it's unfortunate, but it's the reality of where we are.
I want to just tell a quick story of the first time you and I actually spoke. We have a mutual friend who was trying to connect us. And so we traded some voicemails and some texts, I think. And when I finally reached you, I said, "Hey, Kevin, Eric Adams here." And you said, rather disappointedly, I might add, "Well, you're obviously not the Eric Adams that's the mayor of New York City." And I said, "Well, no, I'm not." And I said, "Well, you're obviously not the Kevin Hooks who starred in Sounder and the White Shadow." And you said, "Well, actually, I am." But the reason I was calling you was to see if I could enlist your help in participating as a mentor in a mentor program that we've started at the regional high school here.
Right.
And you immediately said yes. And you said, "Listen, I'm super busy. I'm going to be all over the place, you know, for the foreseeable future. But I want to be involved." And you came to one of our meetings. And I just wanted to ask you why that's so important.
Well, because, you know, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to that. And no, I was not trying to diminish the the self-esteem or the Eric Adams who offers so much to so many.
Come on, move on to the question.
Yeah, okay. All right. No, it's always been very important for me. And I think I got this from my father most, because he was a guy who went into the communities and started theater programs. He did it in New York. He did it in Washington, D.C. with the D.C. Black Repertory Company. And they performed a lot in the public parks in front of, you know, people in the community for free. They did a lot of things in the community. And I saw that model when I was growing up. And it's been very important to me throughout my life. And, you know, and sometimes it's hard when you are busy, you know, to get in there and do that. But when you called and you told me what you guys were doing over at the high school and with those kids, and you were at the early stages in particular of putting it together, I thought, yeah, I have to get involved in that. And that's one of the reasons why I came to the Vineyard to begin with. And that's one of the things that I love about it is, you know, community and people that are really involved in the community in so many different ways. And I thought this was another way that I could give back. And, you know, I definitely, you know,
oh, you're in
wanna
now,
be
no
involved.
Matter where you go, you're involved.
I'm there.
Kevin, you also, you talked about the fact that you didn't go to college.
No.
But yet you are ending up as a teacher at a historically black college, Morehouse University.
Yeah, well, again, that's, you know, when I, no, I didn't. I was, because I started out as a young actor, I was so tempted by the time I got out of high school to go straight to Los Angeles and see what I could do. I did enroll in community college in LA when I got there. And then I was there for about a year. before the White Shadow came up. And then, of course, I had to drop out. I was in the workforce, and that was that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, when I was approached, when I quote-unquote retired mm-hmm. in 2020, I was approached by a young lady at the cinema department in, at Morehouse College, who was very interested in bringing me on to teach a directing class for seniors there. And I thought, you know, hey, I'm retired. This is a way that I can, you know, connect with the community there, young black men, and really sort of give some of my experience and knowledge to some younger filmmakers. And so I went down there and taught for a semester right before the pandemic really kicked in. And I enjoyed it. I did. It was, you know, I loved connecting with those young kids and making, you know, helping them along and really sort of being a part of their lives in a way that, they might not ordinarily have. Mm. So, you know, I may wind up going back there, in the near future.
I hope
we'll
you
see.
Do. I yeah. hope you do. You yeah. have a lot to offer, Kevin.
Thanks.
You've already given us quite a bit with your work and just in your spirit of giving back to us already.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Shed has been brought to you by the Vineyard Gazette. It is produced by Eric Adams, Bill Evel, Chris Fisher, Amy Schumer, and Jack Ebby, with audio production by Anthony Esposito and Dana Edelman.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Shed with Eric Adams. What you just heard was from the second season of Shed back in 2023, presented to you now by MVY Radio.